Most of us have already heard about the quantum computing revolution that is almost upon us, and traveling along with it a new world of cryptography, cybersecurity, and of course, cybercrime. Not all of us are aware, however, of the magnitude of the change that needs to be made. It's not like swapping out one component of a network for a newer, bigger, faster one. The issue is a lot larger than that. As one of my guests on this episode puts it, it's like the rivets on a ship. There are lots of small parts holding the cyber world together. Moving toward the age of post-quantum cryptography and repositioning our existing data security infrastructure around it relies on timely adaptation and immediate action with a budget to match. This is a new world of super high-capacity computers, after all, but how ready are we? How ready are you to hear that when it comes to a quantum-based world, 1 + 1 might no longer equal 2? I'm Steve Prentice, and this is the Talos Security Sessions podcast. To help us understand where we are in the field of post-quantum cryptography, I am honored to be joined by three well-recognized experts. Dr. Michaela Mosca is co-founder, president, and CEO of Evolution Q, Incorporated. Dr. Taher Elgamal is partner at Evolution Equity Partners, father of SSL, and cryptography expert and advisor. And Blair Canavan is from the Talos Digital Identity and Security team. Gentlemen, it is such an honor to have the three of you together here in this virtual room for this short time. I just want to welcome you all to the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. Talos has been a partner for InfoSec Global, a company that I started a few years ago, and they're dear friends.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here with my great colleagues.
Thank you very much. I'm very, very honored to be amongst my peers here today. So thanks again for inviting me today.
So let's start with a simple definition. I'm sure you have given this one out many times before, but it is helpful to set the stage by ensuring a correct terminology. Our topic centers around post-quantum cryptography. So in brief, what does that mean? Michele?
Well, post-quantum cryptography is cryptography designed for the era where we have quantum computers, and very importantly, doesn't require quantum computing to implement the cryptography. So it's a David versus Goliath situation, and David with the classical existing technologies can implement cryptographic algorithms secure against an adversary with quantum computers.
Taher, what do you wish to add to this?
Yeah, it's been known for some 30 years that when a big enough quantum computer were to arrive, that existing public key cryptography would be subject to certain attacks that the quantum computer can actually do. That's why there is a topic for post-quantum cryptography in the first place. Now, we're getting close to an actual quantum computer, so the subject is real.
And how close are we getting? Is it something that people should be preparing for within the next 5 years? Or is it something as real as AI is right now? Michele?
I would argue, yes, it depends on your risk tolerance. By the time we're certain of the timeline, we're too late to do anything about it. And if your risk tolerance is in the few percent range, 5 to 10% even, I would say you better have a plan for 5 years from now. And that's really aggressive timeline, but which critical infrastructure is willing to just accept a 5 to 10% risk of systemic collapse without doing something about it? And by the time you're at 10 years, then the risk is, I would say, closer to 30%. I mean, there's varying opinions, but I would say my view is sort of middle of the pack amongst experts. So the risk is already material in 5 years, certainly in 10 years. Is it certain? No. But again, certainty, you certainly wouldn't bet. We don't want to be playing Russian roulette with something so fundamental.
And what do you see, Blair? What do you see in terms of the threats or the dangers? If quantum is not given the attention and the resources required right now, what kinds of things are organizations facing as potential dangers?
Well, the immediate risk is organizations that they're indifferent. So they're perhaps caught up in the hype curve and the misinformation. And it's the same applies to AI and what's the threat of AI as well as what's the benefits of AI, the threat of quantum computing and the benefits of quantum computing. So there's a lot of misinformation. But I think the most important thing that Michaela can certainly and Tahir can certainly speak to is that preparation is an absolute requirement right now. And I think if we think of ourselves pragmatically as right to left thinkers, I'd like to think we do, the time to prepare is now. And those that are speculating and think they have a crystal ball or leverage whatever resources they have to make some determination of the eventuality of a cryptographically relevant quantum computer, all of that still is moot simply because we know it's within the realm of possible. And with that, we have to prepare now. And the preparation now is arguably going to take, it's not going to be done in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. It's going to be a long time to do this major uplift, the biggest uplift in cryptography in history. So I think I liken it, and I'm sure we can get opinions on analogies, but I liken it to every rivet on a ship, whether it's at sea or a plane in the sky. You don't have the luxury of bringing everything into dry dock. You don't have the luxury of doing it all at once in a swipe of the mouse. It's got to be done systematically, and that is an undertaking that none of us have ever seen in our careers or our histories. So I think this is, without sounding too the sky is falling or what have you, it's not that. It's less about prediction and more about preparation.
And Tahir, what are we preparing for? Is the focus on the data that we need to protect, or is it more about the physical infrastructure that holds and transports the data for us?
So here's how I look at this. Cryptography is foundational to every digital enterprise, which is 100% of enterprises, and to the digital society at large. There's no person, you know, that doesn't use the digital world in any way, shape, or form. When we designed these systems, and that was 30 years ago, we embedded cryptography inside the systems. And we actually told people, please don't touch this stuff. You don't know what you're doing. We know what we're doing. We're just going to get it done right, and you use the APIs on top, and things will be fine. It turns out we were both right and wrong, just like human beings always are. Because you can't really get a lot of people to fiddle with the details of how cryptography is implemented. It's a very, very special skill. But being so embedded makes change really difficult. This is what Blair was actually referring to. Why is it going to take 10 years? And 10 years appears to be the number that people refer to when we talk to like bank CISOs and the like. That's actually the number they say. The reason is the embedding part. So there is no separate infrastructure that has cryptography in it that you can pick up and replace. Like right now, you can actually download an app on your phone and the app is running and everything is okay. There is no equivalent for cryptography. You have to update entire things, entire huge things. And, you know, if we look at enterprise applications, the majority of them have cryptography that is actually years old. It's probably weak even without a quantum computer. And, you know, for all likelihood, the developers that built these things, you know, are retired. So the knowledge about how this whole thing works is actually below what we would like to see. So, you know, we need to sort of enable people to change how cryptography is implemented in the world without getting every developer in the, you know, every developer to rewrite their own cryptography, because that's still not going to work. But by building sort of new infrastructure to enable people to understand what they have, what they actually need to change, what the priorities are. You know, when you have 1,000 applications, nobody's going to be able to update cryptography in 1,000 applications at the same time. So all of this, the project management of this project will be actually a massive size project. This is not going to be a small effort.
That doesn't sound like great news.
There is great news. I apologize for interrupting. The great news is there are people who can actually help you.
The way you describe it, it sounds like a Y2K type of crisis, and one that demands that we pull people together from all over the world to fix all of the world's computers at the same time. If this is indeed a fair analogy, Michaela, can you share with us what you have experienced in terms of either acceptance or rejection of these concepts, or even that kind of passive dismissal that happens when someone says the sky is falling? I'm sure that many people or companies are dealing with more immediate problems right now. So are you seeing that? Or are people genuinely picking up on the urgency? Are people paying attention, or is there a battle to fight here too?
It's, I think, what Manfred Lochter from the BSI describes as Schopenhauer's, you know, three phases. and all truths go through three stages of ridicule, violent opposition, and then accept the self-evident. And, you know, I went through those phases. And so different organizations are at different stages of this truth. And there's but he said, you know, there's a fourth stage where the people who are ridiculing and opposing you say, why aren't you done yet? And we have people in that stage too, where their customers suddenly realize, uh-oh, like, what do you mean our data is vulnerable? And every day that goes by, there's all this accumulating, you know, cyber debt and cyber risk, like, get this done. And they want it done faster than the NSA is asking its vendors to do it. And, you know, vendors can't. I mean, if you needed that, you had to ask sooner. But customers always right, so they want you to go faster. So there's a bit of that. But I think for many people, they're still, you know, saying, well, what is quantum and why should I worry about this, you know, compared to all the other cyber threats I have? Of course, you still have to worry about all the other things. But when you're talking about something as systemic and deeply ingrained, as Tahar outlined, this is, you know, could be an existential threat. You not only have to, you know, mitigate the quantum-enabled attacks. If you try to rush this, systems will fail simply because of software mistakes. No attackers. There'll be zero-day attacks that can be attacked with regular computers. People will lose confidence in your systems. And then you'll probably eventually be offside of regulatory requirements if you're a laggard here. So there's lots of really important business drivers. Just financial regulators globally just a few days ago released yet another report indicating increasing urgency to get prepared for this. So it's starting, you know, things have been moving. Again, different people are in different parts of this awareness, these four stages, and there's still a lot more work to be done.
So while we stay with the three or maybe four phases of this inconvenient truth, there's also the fact that we're not on a level playing field, globally speaking. There are all kinds of geopolitical issues going on, and in terms of cybersecurity, there's no shortage of financially motivated nation states who are eager to take advantage of confusion or large-scale change. Do you anticipate that there may be a significant strategic benefit for those who are interested in taking advantage of the potential chaos that this transition to post-quantum encryption might force upon the world?
Well, I think we all appreciate that humans can be corrupted, and we know that nation states and others that have nefarious reasons to steal, to obtain, to compromise will do so. There's no way that we can predict how it's going to occur, but I think we are all understanding that, for example, this race to the moon equivalent is being led by, for example, we know statistically that China is spending upwards of 15 plus billion on quantum research and so on. At least we know that we have those sources, which collectively supersedes all other nations combined. I haven't got the latest statistics in front of me, but obviously Western civilization is saying, is that a good thing for that to be lost to? Again, we can speculate on what that would mean. Would it be IP theft? Would it be nation secrets? Would it be, we don't know, but we're going to speculate that this has been going on since the beginning of time in the digital world, that compromise and stealing of information and financial gain is one of the main reasons. That being said, it's not like every organization is going to have access to these quantum computers. These are not going to be sitting, as Tahir would like to think, a Christmas present under the tree, for example. We all know what those little Raspberry Pis look like today, but let's talk about a viable quantum computer in a data center. They're going to be strictly managed, and access to those is going to be only for those that provide the credentials to do so, at least in the side of the business, the positive side, the Western side of that. Others are going to do these things in the shadows, and we can only surmise what that's going to look like. I guess back to the sky is falling. That's a risk that we all anticipate, and that's the ultimate risk of compromise. But we're going to see information that was never accessible over the last, as Tahir said, since the history of let's just say the last 30 years, to keep it within the confines of RSA encryption and so on, public key especially. We now know that organizations will have at it, and we won't get an announcement in the paper. There won't be something on the web that tells everybody that it's now available and everybody has free access. This is going to be something that happens in the shadows. Unlike Y2K, which was a date and time, we don't have a Y2Q date. We can only assume that it's going to happen, and it's not going to be announced, and we're not all going to be kept apprised of all the details.
I just would add that black hats will, of course, find a way to bypass the know your client, you know, attempts to keep only nice people on the platforms. So there's going to be a risk. I mean, the harder you make it for enemies, the harder it's going to be for legitimate users. But they'll get in, and they may eventually get detected, but they'll be able to get a lot of useful information out.
Would you imagine that some existing proactive defense in depth would be important here to make that happen? Because since there's a perceptual schism between, you know, our existing computing systems and then the whole quantum world, we hear stories every day about data breaches, which appear to be much more of a lower threat level. But the issue is that when threat actors get inside an organization, not to steal data, but to embed themselves into a company and move about laterally, does this raise a red flag? Is it important for us to explain to perhaps the executives again who have not had a chance to connect the dots that if you have threat actors who have already found a way to get inside the network, they might be happy just to sit there and lurk, waiting for this chaos opportunity to happen? Or is it too much of a stretch to make that assumption?
Well, the threat model, which is kind of what you're talking about, the threat model that we live in today was built on the fact that cryptography actually works. So if you look into any enterprise security program, all the projects that exist in that program assume that, you know, TLS works and IPsec works and all that, the encryption at rest works. And then you design the layers on top. If the foundation is actually not working correctly, then you have to change the entire set of assumptions. It's not a matter of adding layers because the assumption itself is wrong. You know, I grew up loving math. So in math, when you study number theory, they tell you there is an assumption that 1 plus 1 equals 2. It's an axiom. There's no proof for it. So if 1 plus 1 is actually not equal to 2, then all the math that we know is wrong, which is kind of fascinating to think about. It's not that dramatic, but it's sort of like this. You know, most of the attacks, when people even lurk inside an organization, it is actually about money at the end of the day. The size of cybercrime in terms of dollars lost is huge. And, you know, there are some countries that have, I think, line items on their budgets that actually is attributed to cybercrime because they depend on that income to actually run the country, believe it or not. It's true. The existential attacks is somebody going to launch war is a much bigger decision that, launching a war needs a lot more than just cryptography and stealing keys. But at the end of the day, when people do a data breach, it's actually mostly about money. You know, my healthcare record may be useful for some people, but for the most part is because they can sell it for a good amount to whoever is collecting these things, and that's a known behavior. So if you break the threat model from the bottom up, things change quite dramatically, actually. The reason that CISOs need to take notice is because whether they actually explicitly know it or not, their security program depends on the fact that cryptography actually works. You may or may not believe that a quantum computer will come in 5 or 15 years, as Michele said. Nobody's going to be able to predict exactly the day. But the preparation will take many years. And it turns out in the middle of this, there is really bad stuff even without a quantum computer. So why don't we just start and fix things? Because, you know, there are things that exist today that, you know, that there is a signing key that is available in a file system of some random computer that somebody can come and steal. And when they steal that, they can actually, you know, put code inside of your own product, which obviously is not a cool thing. So it's just being underestimated because, my fault, Michele, you were not around then, but my fault, because we actually told people cryptography will be taken care of by the vendors, which, you know, I mean, all the companies do take care of cryptography, But if you leave it for 15 years, it's guaranteed to be actually bad news.
In Taher's defense now, for many years, though, Taher has been advocating for, you know, so-called agility, or the ability to replace an algorithm much more rapidly than we currently can. So anticipating that these could be broken and realizing it's so embedded, we don't keep track of it, we don't manage it. So if there's ever a need to rapidly change an algorithm, assuming we even have one ready to go, so we didn't have them ready to go, and we weren't ready to move them quickly. So I remember one of my first meetings with Taher, he's like, I don't know about this quantum threat you're talking about, but I like that you're making a case for cryptographic agility. And basically, I think the big lesson here isn't just replace this code that we know to break with another one we hope isn't broken, but we have to manage cryptography much more maturely, given that it's the foundation of the economy now. And that includes so-called agility, and I won't get into what exactly that means, but agility is really all about, if it ever is broken, we can get the systems back up and running at full strength sufficiently quickly, which depends on the system, exactly what that means. And it also means to recover, it has to be a recoverable event. So adversaries don't always tell you in advance when they've broken your codes. And the smart mathematician could put, you know, there have been some of the, you know, NIST finalists that were broken on a weekend in a laptop. For those, agility is not always going to be enough. Like saying, sorry, all your money was stolen, all your infrastructure was destroyed, but don't worry, we're going to have something new to sell you right after is not good enough for certain systems. So there you need a different kind of defense in depth than you were referring to. But there you need some cryptographic diversity and defense in depth to sort of bound the blast radius for some of the more critical systems. So what we want when we get to the other side of this post-quantum migration is not just reestablishing the same precarious situation we're in, but have a much more mature handling of our cryptography and readiness to respond to unexpected events in the future.
There's sort of an interesting phenomenon here, which is, yes, the vendors will supply products that are good at the time they're being supplied. But if something wrong were to happen, it's actually the customer that's liable. The data is owned by whoever is running the data center or the app or whatever, whoever is actually responsible for the thing. The cryptography vendor is not actually liable, you know, especially when something has been used for 15 years without even being looked at. You know, no vendor is going to provide something to a customer, say, yeah, just use this until the end of time and life is good.
I was going to add the one thing that we're moving from a presumptive model to an inspect what you expect, or you know, there's going to be an incredible amount of vetting going forward because we've presumed that we knew what we were using, or the assumption was that the ingredients of the software bill of materials or the cryptographic bill of materials was, to Tahir's point, sound. And why would we think twice about it? And now that spotlight is turned on that, I think going forward, the positive impact this is going to have is now we're going to understand the ingredients of our applications. And we're going to understand at a whole nother level why we're managing cryptography differently. Even to a point where, for those who have curated cryptography for the last 30 years, a couple of people on this call, know that we can't just train everybody to be cryptographers. So there's another side to this, which is, you know, abstracting crypto and orchestrating crypto, which I think is incredibly interesting for all of us. It's a byproduct of moving to PQC readiness, which is understanding what we have. And then when we do the migration and we uplift our existing crypto, which some people will say legacy, and I always have to say, let's call it operational. Yes, there are some algorithms that are deprecated, shouldn't be there in the first place. But guess what? When we put a spotlight on it and we investigate and do crypto discovery and inventory, now we're going to look at this from an approach going forward of how do we automate some of that away from everybody that they don't have to think about cryptography? Case in point, just use the word encrypt or sign and have a policy to manage what that actual algorithm is or what that actual implementation is going to look like. And that gives, for all of us on this call and around this, imagine that you now have a new way of implementing cryptography that allows it to be really agile, meaning that we're going to manage it as a policy as opposed to as an ingredient in a piece of software, which, by the way, that's really hard to explain to any new developer what cryptography is or why they need to use it. Well, again, these are examples of this is going to get better. Our software development life cycles are going to get better, and we're going to embed security or build security in I think, better than we ever have. But that's my humble opinion. I'm sure my colleagues can add some details to that.
I think certain developers need to understand what cryptography is, actually. I don't think people should hide behind that anymore. It's like certain engineers need to understand what an open TCP port is, because that allows a hack to come in. Most people are just going to ignore the subject and move on. But there has to be a certain group who are actually responsible for managing these openings that somebody from the outside can come through.
Wow. The image that this puts in my mind, rightly or wrongly, is like in the movie Jaws. When you don't get to see the shark for most of the movie, you just know it's there, which is scary enough. And what the three of you have done in this last half an hour is to throw a little more chum into the water by highlighting the most inconvenient outcome of Schopenhauer's truth model, which might be the confusion or denial of the magnitude of the PQC challenge, after all. Are there any words of comfort that we can provide for those who are now contemplating the work that we all seem to have in front of us?
Navigating this new terrain, it's you know, new for everyone, but there's a lot of expertise out there. A lot of best practices have been developed and they're shared. And I mean, Blair's on one or more of these working groups globally that are developing these best practices. So there's lots of reliable advice to start with. And lots of reliable companies and other organizations to help with that journey as well. So 10 years ago, I once had a company say, "You're right. What do I do?" And then I realized, "Oh, you can't do anything because there isn't a reliable implementation of the cryptography. There are no there was nothing." But we've come a long way in the last 10 years, and there are many great starting points and great organizations to help you with that journey. You're ultimately responsible for your journey, but there's many people to guide you in designing your roadmap and your journey and then implementing it.
You know, at the end of the day, it's about prioritization. So why would somebody say that, you know, adjusting the cryptography stack is a priority for my company? And that requires understanding. That's not the question to actually ask. The question they ask is, what is the risk if the cryptography you're using was broken? What piece of the business would be, you know, broken or stolen or whatever the attack wants to do? And then manage the priorities according to the risk rather than according to sort of the, you know, natural way of thinking, until this becomes part of all security programs, basically.
And Blair?
I couldn't agree more. Adding to that is simply just reemphasizing what Michaela and Tahir have said, that there is no question that we don't have 20 years to think about this and kick the can down the hall. And nobody knows it better than Michaela, who's been leading the effort, whether it be the Quantum Institute or what you've been doing as a pragmatist in all this. I think we're at that stage of, as I said, less predicting and more preparation. We know that any industry that is faced with this type of a challenge knows how long it takes. And crypto uplift has been traditionally very difficult to do. And still, we can argue that we know old bad crypto is still there. So imagine that we now have to take care of that and take care of the stuff like RSA and ECC that works. It works today and arguably could work, like I said, for another 1,000 years. But guess what? We have a lot of work to do to make these changes. And I'll echo again, seeking knowledge and expertise is great, but you got to start a plan. You've got to have a tiger team. You've got to have individuals within the organization, and you need to pull that together. And the good news is, as Tahir said, there are lots of companies now preparing and building practices around helping you get there. Large systems integrators is a good example. But also this I say, inclusive ecosystem that we belong to. We are working together, and I've never seen better collaboration between whether it's competitors or that we see each day in the streets to, those that just fit together and work together. So I couldn't say enough. I'm very biased because I work in the world of ecosystems, but I'd like to just say that I couldn't be more impressed with the way that people are approaching this to gather the the world's best and attacking this head on. So,
well, that sounds a little more encouraging. We don't need to have everyone reinventing the wheel simultaneously. There is help out there, but it is vital that a plan be put in place now if it hasn't already. So all that remains for me is to thank you all for being here today. I know you have probably delivered this message many times before, but as I said at the start, the magnitude of quantum computing makes it vital that your message be heard as often as possible. Taher, thank you so much for being here on the podcast today.
Thank you, Steve, for inviting me to be here. This is a very good opportunity for us to actually work together to advance the world. I appreciate being here.
And Michaela, same thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Blair, same thing. Thank you very much for being here today.
Couldn't say thank you enough. I appreciate everybody coming together today and look forward to next steps.
Remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and tell a friend or a colleague or a client or all of them about the Talos Security Sessions podcast. We will be back again soon with another episode and another discussion on the topics that you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. Until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.